Blog Talk Radio. This is Rare Bird Radio. I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, author of the poetry collection Eighth and Agony out on Punk Hostage Press, and you are listening to Poetescape. Welcome on this fine Sunday afternoon, first day of daylight savings time, and happy springing forward. Hope that springing forward is going well for you. With me today is Jace Daniel, author of the novel Under Angels, who, by the way, one of his crowning achievements as a child was when he solved a Rubik's Cube in under a minute, and he hadn't even taken off the stickers yet. I think that's pretty amazing. Welcome, Jace.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me, Rich. Good morning. Happy spring forward.
Yes, absolutely. Hey, I was wondering if you could tell the audience to begin, talk a little about Under Angels, the premise, where you are with things these days.
Absolutely. Under Angels is it's a supernatural thriller. I wrote it as a novel back in 2009. It's a ghost story. I think you'll dig it. I've also adapted it to a screenplay that's getting some attention. It recently won a contest, so it's about to go into circulation this spring.
Very nice.
It takes place in L.A. It's got a lot of stuff that people will dig. It's got the tunnels under L.A. It's got dogs. It's got love. It's got suicide. It's got a great human story behind it, and some World War II history.
Dogs, love, and suicide. What else do you need? You know. Now, when I first met you, you were actually still in the process, I believe, of blogging your novel, which you refer to as a blovel. I was hoping you could talk about that process because I find it very fascinating, and an aspect of that, which I also find fascinating, which can also get us off into some tangents later on, the idea of structure and how you set that structure up for yourself.
I could do tangents. We could do five tangents at a time if you want.
Exactly.
Back in 2008, I had this big story in my head, and in the summer of 2008, I kind of jammed it out as a treatment, if you will, or an outline, just to kind of get it on the page, get it in front of me, get it done. It ended up being a 26-chapter outline. I kind of shelved it. That was in June. As the new year rolled, the year rolled on, we were approaching the new year there in December. And one night, I was found in the back of my truck. I found this printout of, you know, this story, and it looked really interesting. I'm like wondering what it was coming from. And it took me about 45 seconds to realize that it was this outline for the story that I had done. So at that point, I realized, man, I got to get back in here and actually read what I had written down, because I forgot. I was like thinking to myself, I forgot about the envelope. I forgot about Greamer, you know. So as a New Year's resolution sort of literary experiment, I vowed publicly on my blog. I kind of have pulled the kimono off anyway, and I throw a lot of my stuff out there online with Twitter and posting short stories and such. So I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm never going to finish this book unless I commit to it in some sort of public way. So as a New Year's resolution, I vowed to take my 26 chapters, and for the year of 2009, I just did some math. It occurred to me that there are 52 weeks in a year. 52 divided by 2 is 26. How about if I do this? Starting on January 1st, I will blog live one chapter every other week for an entire year. I don't know if it would be good, but if at the very least, by the time I got to the finish line, I'd at least have it in front of me, which is the whole point of a first draft anyway, you know, with a big piece of fiction, you can't see it until it's out there. So
exactly.
I embarked on that, you know, and I set up a schedule. So January 1st, I did the first chapter. When I said do the first chapter, I was working from my very, very loose outline and fleshing things out and building the story. And it was, you know, I knew the basic roadmap. I knew all the signposts, but I just didn't know exactly how I was going to get there. But anyway, I started on January 1st, Chapter 1, January 15th, Chapter 2, January 29th, and so on, all the way down the line. Spent the entire year of May of 2009 doing that with no breaks. I think I met you right around May or June, so I was really in the
yep.
trenches there. I got all the way down the stretch, hit about September as I was hitting the third act, and it was a real sort of surreal year, man. It's supernatural or paranormal is the way to describe the experience. I mean, there's so many things about life that were paralleling the story, and the story was paralleling everything that was happening in the world, and there was all this kind of give and take. It was almost a process of discovery, more than invention in a way. But anyway, I got to December 31st and finished it. People had been reading it, you know, some more diligently than others. I hadn't really read anything as I was doing it. But once I got to the end of the year there, I shelved it and for about 6 months walked away from it. You know, that was an accomplishment in itself just to get it done. But after about 6 months, I went back and looked at it again because I had not read what I had done. And I was really enjoying the story because I'm a fan of it anyway. I mean, the only reason I wrote it is because I love the story. So with the luxury of more time and less rigid deadlines, so to speak, that was on me during the 2009 thing, I went back and started rewriting. I fleshed things out. I wrote a couple more chapters in the middle to, you know, further flesh out the villain and the stakes and a little bit more of the world and the logic of the world and stuff. Finished on Halloween of 2010,
nice.
Which is appropriate because it's a ghost story. And then I went into like editing mode and really kind of getting the thing ready to go. I started adapting it to a screenplay. And right about in 2011, I kind of turned my attention from the adapted screenplay thing, and I realized that I got to get this thing out there on Kindle, which is, you know, kind of another topic of self-publishing. But I said, you know, I'm an online guy. I've been doing this since the 90s, the whole web thing, you know, producing content, throwing it out there. So the very first thing I did is I polished up that manuscript and I put it on Kindle in 2011. And that's where I started realizing, wow, people are really getting, you know, they're reacting to the story in a real way. They're getting it, you know, and it's real cool to get these anonymous reviews from people, you know, who are out and, you know, buying the thing. So when the Kindle was out there, I realized everybody kept asking for the paperback. And I'm like, well, let's just do that too. So I kind of took the manuscript and started going into like the mechanical process of building the manuscript. I worked with an editor and some proofreaders and got the thing down to a polished diamond, you know. I did the cover artwork, I did the blurb, I did a lot of the marketing myself, I busted out a trailer.
What you're very good at, by the way, that's one of the things I admire about you. Not only are you a really wonderful creative writer, but you are really, from what I've seen, really, really good at promotion too, and that's not easy at all.
Thanks, man. Thanks. Yeah, I do have a marketing background. You know, the day job has been in areas of marketing and graphic design and interactive media, and I did a lot of flash and animation and web, you know, all that stuff. So with that kind of background, I found myself in a fortunate situation to have all these sort of skills in my back pocket that I've been doing for so long that are totally relevant now with what I was trying to do with Under Angels. So, I mean, you know, formatting the ebook, formatting the manuscript for print, the, you know, working with templates, the layout, the cover art, the Photoshop, all that stuff. I threw it out there, got the thing the paperback done in May of 2012, last year, and threw that out there and had some support from people in town here in L.A. And I did a few book signings. The book's now available in some stores around town, Book Soup.
A couple
on
of which I've attended.
Yes, you have, and you were always very supportive with that, brother. You know,
absolutely,
one of the real ones.
No.
An inspiration. But yeah, you can, anybody, if they're old school, they can actually walk in and go pick up a copy at Book Soup on Sunset or Chevalier's on Larchmont, Skylight Books in Los Feliz. In the Valley, you could try Psychic Eye or Dark Delicacies. And then,
and of
down
course,
in,
also Amazon online.
And then, of course, there's Amazon for the Kindle version as well as the paperback. You can pick it up on Amazon or CreateSpace.
Now, I'm curious,
yep.
And this is something I wrestle with myself, the balance of self-promotion versus writing, because as we both know, and you especially, because I think you've sort of tackled this beast better than I have in some ways, the idea of self-promotion. And it takes a lot of time. And I'm wondering how you're able to, and also with having a day job, because, you know, I also have a job. I'm a teacher. And that in and of itself takes up time.
Right.
So when you talk about that amount of time being used, and then you get into the whole idea, okay, I have this amount of time over here I can use for my writing, and I can, or, you know, I can use for my self-promotion. How are you able to balance that for yourself, saying, okay, this amount of time I'm going to allot for self-promotion? I mean, are you really scheduled like that, or how does it work?
Well, I think the whole shebang comes in seasons. So, you know, there's the outlining, the heavy lifting, the storytelling itself. Then there's the mechanical part of actually, you know, getting pages done. Then there's the editing, and then there's the artwork, and then kind of the brainstorming and of how we're going to do this, or what kind of, you know, we're going to do this on Twitter, going to set up Facebook stuff, we're going to do book trailers, we're going to do free book promotions, try to get on Pixel Link and stuff like that. So as far as the balance, there's no way I could do all of it. It's not like I'm writing and then turning around and trying to figure out what I'm going to do about promoting it. It really goes in waves. So, you know, weeks of at a time, you know, every month would be different throughout the whole process. So, like, for instance, the story, I did the first thing in 2009. Then 2010 was more of a reading and a rewriting year for me, and then some polishing. And then actually there was a couple months of just getting the thing on Kindle. And then there was another sort of 6 months of preparing the manuscript for the paperback. And then when that was done, then you have to kind of, like, figure out, you know, distribution and stuff like that, set up some book signings, promotion, you know, for me, I haven't done, you know, there's never enough promotion. I've done as much as I possibly can. For me, you know, you got to kind of pick and choose the most effective ways. I realized that YouTube is, you know, it's one of the biggest search engines on the globe right now. And if you could set up a cool book trailer, a 30-second or a 60-second spot that can tell the story in a succinct sort of way, just the elevator pitch on YouTube that can kind of kick ass, grab some attention, and direct people to where they can find more.
Speaking of which, I have you to thank for creating my kick ass book trailer.
My pleasure,
Ethan,
dude. Yeah, really, I love your work. I had a lot of fun doing that. It was really cool to kind of get in there and do a lot with the audio, particularly with a lot of fun. So,
since you're out there in so many different ways, you know, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, you know, you have your own blog, you've done book signings. Is there any one particular avenue where you feel people have responded to you more favorably, or you've been able to gather more friends, more contacts, more readership?
Well, I think Amazon is a huge part of this whole machine, this whole, you know, thing that's happening right now. There are so many people out there. Everything seems to be colliding at the same time. Technology, Kindles, you know, the Kindles are getting better. They're getting cheaper. More and more people are having devices now. Everybody has a phone. You can get the Kindle app. So I think it reminds what's happening right now with e-books reminds me a lot of what was happening with the internet, when the internet hit in the 90s. There was an immediacy about having your content out there. You can just, you know, if you had the know-how and the time, you can set up your stuff, set up a web page, and have it live immediately. A similar thing with Amazon, you know, getting, you know, you can, you know, it's within a matter of hours, you can have your stuff up live, ready to go, and exposed to millions of people. So the audience there is almost unparalleled on Amazon. Twitter, you know, Twitter kind of supplements all that, and your blog, of course, is. And the ultimately, you're driving people to Amazon to download or, you know, to purchase the extra story and experience it themselves. And then, you know, there's a real key thing about, you know, as soon as you do that kind of ground roots or grassroots stuff, reviews are big. You know, we're in this whole, I don't know, we used to call it Web 2.0 a couple of years ago, but I think, you know, what's been happening in the world now is people, word of mouth, and, you know, we as people on the web tend to place more legitimacy on user reviews and people just like us who like a movie or a book or a product or something like that. So If you can get out there and have enough people read it, get some reviews, it kind of takes off from there. And another real magic thing about Amazon is the whole sort of algorithm, that's that whole also bot, right? So, you know, people who like this also like this, people who like this also like this. So that just means that the more people that are exposed to your stuff, it's just going to kind of bleed through and find more readers ultimately.
Exactly. You know, one of the the way we originally met was through our dear friend, writer and teacher, Tony Lafferty. Another way we met.
Great man.
Or another way we have a connection is through, and I'm sure we'll both agree, the amazing Larry Smith at Smith Magazine.
Larry.
Most famously known for his six-word memoirs. And talking about structure, I mean, you know, and structure, again, is going to be something we keep coming back to in this episode. But talk about a brilliant form of structure. And I've taken part in one of his live shows in San Francisco,
sure.
But I was wondering if you could talk about your experience with Larry.
Absolutely. Back in 2006, there was this little site called Twitter that we were all kind of noodling off on, and you can fire off these little CB radio style electronic messages in text using 140 characters or less. And I was one of the first people who were just like, wow, this is great, because I'm a real stream of consciousness guy anyway. I'm the kind of guy who writes on a napkin, leaves myself voice messages, post-it notes. Just all these little anecdotes or thoughts or jokes or ideas that I don't want to forget. Twitter allowed, particularly with Twitter along with cell phones, right? Because you can tweet using your phone. So you could be on the freeway, or don't do that now, but you could be walking your dog. And, you know, there are so many times, you know, there's this whole saying that's true, you know, as a writer, you need to have a notebook with you everywhere you go, because you never know when that thing's going to hit the muse or the idea or that revelation, and you want to capture that because you're just not going to remember it unless you document it somehow. And for me, Twitter was perfect for that kind of thing, because I just kind of threw it out there. Larry, back in 2006, end of 2006, I got an email from my friend. He said, listen, go do this on Twitter. Twitter was having this sort of contest, and the contest was conducted by Twitter, and it was sponsored by Twitter, I should say, and conducted by Smith Magazine in New York, and it was called a six-word memoir. I think it was just called a six-word memoir contest. And the basic idea is based on this urban legend of Ernest Hemingway. Not entirely correct, but he was challenged to write his entire life in six words. Maybe it was even on a soggy bar napkin, just to make it more graphic. But he wrote For Sale, Baby Shoes Never Worn. And it's a classic. It's become a real starting point for conversation in writer circles. And Smith took Larry and his team took that whole idea and decided, let's just kind of like take that structure of, you know, the six words, an American haiku, if you want to call it that, and throw it out there with Twitter and see what people could come up with. Because, you know, Twitter is about brevity. Six words is about brevity. Less is more. See what happens. So I saw this email, and I went over to the site, and I just immediately, the very first thing that came to my mind, I banged it out and sent it off. And that was kind of it. But months later, I got an email from the editor there at Smith, and they're like, hey, listen, I don't know if you remember, but there was this, you know, Twitter thing that we did with Smith and the six-word memoirs, and we really liked yours, and we got a book deal, and we're going to have yours in the book. I'm like, wow, that was
well done.
So cool, man, so cool. And so I went out there for to New York for the release party, met a lot of great people, and developed new relationships and a lot of like minds and stuff like that. And then the book did really well. It hit the, you know, New York Times bestseller list. They got the very follow-up year, they got to do a sequel on that book, but it was more themed, a more themed thing, and it was six-word memoirs on love and heartbreak. And I just kind of sent one off as well, and it wasn't until, like, the day before it came out that the editor emailed me. I guess I had an email in my spam folder or something. I didn't even realize I was in that one, too. So went out there, but Larry's the best, man. So, you know, he does book tours, and I always try to hook up with him every time he's out here in L.A. He and Piper are awesome. Check out her book. And it's a good community over there. It's all about writing, you know.
Yeah, I was in a collection of his called The Moment, which wasn't a six-word piece. It was basically a premise where different artists or whatever were asked to write about a pivotal moment in their lives and how it changed them in some way or another.
Yes.
But yeah, like I said before, I participated in one of his live six-word memoir events in San Francisco as part of one of Stephen Elliott's Rumpus events. Giving another shout out to Stephen Elliott, he's pretty amazing. But yeah, Larry Smith just basically had a whole line of people in the makeout room bar, and they just filed up on the stage one by one, got on the mic, did their six-word memoir, and then, you know, got off the stage, and it was good fun. You know, you mentioned that you have now written or are in the process of writing Under Angels as a screenplay. I'm wondering what that's like, shifting your focus from a novel and then adapting it as a screenplay. What kind of different skills
Absolutely.
Do you have to use
it's become,
to go from one to the other?
Sure. It's become one of my favorite topics and very much at the forefront of my consciousness right now and where my energy is going. I actually have it's already been adapted to a script, so I'm not really working on it. I did one final polish, and I think we're about ready to go out with it. Screenplay form is a very rigid form of storytelling that I personally like. Speaking of brevity and six words and all that stuff, and less is more and 140 characters, there are similar limitations with a screenplay. You know, everything has to be very economical. There's a focus on everything's got to be really tight. You want to use a lot of white space down the page. There's a lot of freedom that we have writing prose and novels that we can't afford to indulge in with a screenplay. It's writing a novel is sort of like I kind of came up with this. Writing a novel is sort of like making music in your home studio, right? No limitations, jam out, whatever you want to do, record it, mix it around, that type of thing. Writing a screenplay, unlike writing a novel, is much more like composing a score of music to be handed off to performers. So there's this line that you're walking where you got to be clear with things, but you can't over-explain things. You got to leave room for interpretation, but you can't be too vague and that type of thing. So I personally, it's a very surgical, very mechanical type of work, which I actually really like because I'm very much into structure and precision and accuracy and tightening things down as hard as they'll go. So adapting Under Angels was a natural extension for me. I've actually had people tell me, I mean, I kind of write, my understanding from what people have commented on is my style of, even my prose reads kind of like a movie. Everybody who's told me, has read this book, or, you know, most people have said, God, this has got to be a movie. I could totally see the movie. And I think they're feeling that because of the style of writing. I do keep things very short.
Yeah. And it's very visual.
Very visual, right, sure. And, you know, what is a movie but a visual, right? I mean, it's, you know, you can't really tell what, you have to show it on screen. That's how people are seeing this, the story happen. It's what you're showing. So I've gotten to the point where I think that the line of that type of writing is, if I had to choose, it's probably what I actually prefer. Particularly even adaptation, taking a book that is a kind of a thick, fat thing and really gleaning the essence of the story out and getting it down in a, you know, it's like kind of like taking the phone book or a huge book of information and getting all the good stuff and putting it on a 3x5 card. And that's kind of like, you know, there's a lot of work involved. But I dig it. And it seems to be effective. People are really liking the movie version, which is cool because, you know, there's so many things in the book that people have reacted to that aren't in the script in the movie. I mean, or they're heavily abbreviated or just implied, but they're still feeling it in the screenplay version, which is encouraging to me. That because that means that there really is something there. There's a real spine there. That's a real thing that translates in both mediums, you know.
Right.
So, and then, you know, I got another comedy in my back pocket that I'm really kind of stoked on too. But we can talk about that on another day.
Oh yeah.
But,
oh yeah. You know, we're both drummers, and so we're very keyed into balancing you know, words with rhythm in relation to, you know, in your case, storytelling, you know, a lot of, you know, poetry. There's a, you know, a certain amount of poetry that's very rooted to structure. Of course, some poetry, you know,
right,
sort of does it, you know, does what it can to break out of structure. But I'm curious, because you have a musical background, because you are sensitive to rhythm, I'm wondering,
yeah,
how you balance that in relation to telling a story and what your process is for putting a story like Under Angels together.
I hear you. Well, I wouldn't call it a balance of structure and storytelling, because that, to me, it implies that they're two different things.
Right.
Structure is at the heart of, well, structure really is at the heart of poetry, right? Poetry,
yeah,
is about expressing feelings and ideas using style and rhythm, you know, in time. And I would argue that, you know, other art forms, or maybe even all art forms, kind of can be looked at that way, whether it's painting or dance, you know, graphic design, architecture, music, you know, even humor, even comedy. Without some sort of structure, you know, the whole thing falls flat. It's like if you're going to go run a race, run a marathon, you didn't have a skeleton, you're going to be just kind of like laying there, just a lump of flesh. You got to have that.
You're going to be the thing other runners are jumping over.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so the balance. Oh, I would say, without structure, there for me, I can't. I guess the question was, how do I balance my thoughts on structure with storytelling itself? I would say that a structure for me is the starting point for the storytelling. So it's at the forefront. I don't even start really sort of writing anything until I have a solid beat sheet, outline, synopsis, whatever you want to call it. Sort of a, you got to know the beginning and the middle and the end. I mean, you know, it kind of goes all the way back to the whole Aristotle's poetics thing. You know, every story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So then starting with that, you got all your real big plot points. You got the beginning, you got the end, you got the midpoint, you got the first plot point, second plot point. So I, you know, there's a lot of conversation that has been, that the people have had on this topic. One of my favorite analogies is, the idea of tent poles. If you're trying to put up a circus tent, you know, you need a few poles to hold the thing up, correctly. So it's holding its shape, you know. So, the tent poles are certain specific things that must happen in the story at certain times. So, you know, you can't just kind of, you know, freestyle and just start going off on page one, page two, page three without really knowing where you're going to go. So the way I see, I never start anything until I really know the end. Sometimes I'll even start with the middle. But once I have those tent poles up, then the storytelling starts kind of falling into place. And having that structure is so important. You talked about drumming. It's like, for me, having an outline is like having a metronome, right? What does a metronome do? It ensures accuracy, and it also gives you a certain amount of confidence when you're jamming. You're not second guessing things that you don't need to be second guessing. It opens you up to spread your wings within that rigid structure, within that time, within that meter, and start exploring ideas within that structure. And storytelling is very much the same way for me. If I know that I'm, you know, I got stuff happening on page 25, page 30, page 55, page 75, and I'm on page 62, I can really gauge where I am, because I know where I'm going to need to be on page 75. And you can just kind of work within that. And so to answer your question, without structure, I would be falling all over. I would be like that. I would be that marathon runner with no skeleton. You know,
right. Now, I want to, you know, there are a lot of things you say about structure I totally agree with, and to some degree work that way myself. You know, I also know writers that have said, you know what, I don't like to plan as I go. I just like to write and see what happens. You know, I'm curious, and I'm bringing this up because, you know, there's that beautiful story of yours about Chapter 9 and Under Angels and how you met your now wife,
right,
Melanie, you know. And
Earthquake.
Exactly. And I want you to talk about that. But my question is, when you set up a structure for yourself, someone might argue, well, if you set up so much structure, you leave out the idea of discovery, and you, you've mapped out so much that you don't leave room for magic to happen. And
yeah, man, you're ignoring the art, man.
Yeah, yeah, you're ignoring the art, man. You're just jamming up the process.
That's right.
I'm just curious if you could talk about that idea of setting structure for yourself, but then allowing magic to happen, like that beautiful story of yours for chapter
nine. That's right. Well, I would say backing up, I would say that, you know, it's you know, people have identified that there are really two mindsets or two approaches to writing a story. There are the two groups of people, I guess you should say, the plotters, the people who really kind of plan things out before they go, and the pantsers, the people who write from the seat of their pants, right? The plotters spend a lot more time, you know, working things out before they even sit down to do the work. Kind of reminds me of that, not to go too far from the tangent, but we are all about tangents today, right?
There's exactly.
Was there Abraham Lincoln, you know, if I had 8 hours to chop down a tree, I'd spend 7 hours sharpening my axe, right? And so that's sort of the plotters. That's the way we look at it. It's like, and you know, I want to get as much done, so by the time I'm actually writing the story's already written in my head, and getting it down, executing it, is much more of a just a mechanical, clerical, almost exercise of typing. The pantsers are more about like, oh man, I want to start and I want the story to come to me, man. I'm going to turn myself off like a faucet, on like a faucet, and I'm just going to kind of follow the muse wherever it takes me. They do that. I like that. There's a lot of fun there. A lot of good stuff can come out of that. But there's a lot of time that you're spending doing that. And inevitably, if you're going to be coming up with a story that works, you're going to get to the end of that story, and then things aren't going to be jiving, and you're going to go back to what is, you know, considered writing itself is rewriting. You go back and you revise. You go back and you look and change. You start identifying, trying to figure out where things are going wrong, what you know, where things are lagging, where things are sagging, where things are happening too fast, that type of thing. And a lot of that rewriting energy can be minimalized, or you know, more efficiently used if you had outlined first. So I think at the end of the day, he wrote a great book. His name is Larry Brooks. He has a book called Story Engineering. Go buy it. And he's very much a left brain sort of approach guy when it comes to exactly what we're talking about. And I think at the end of the day, the pantsers, the people who are the discoverers, who think that they're discovering it along the way, when it's all said and done, they've done so much rewriting to get the thing to work that you could argue that they had actually outlined it anyway. So they're just outlining at the end, you know. They're outlining as they go. It's not that they're not outlining. It's just that they're not getting it out of the way before they started writing, you know.
Right.
So do what works for you, you know. I find that if I don't outline, I might come up with something interesting, but I'm not coming up with something that's going to work or is really marketable, you know what I mean, which is important for me anyway.
So chapter nine. So
yes.
Now the room for having the structure but leaving the room for the magic, if you could talk
about
that.
That's right. Oh, you want to get in that little personal anecdote?
Yeah, if you're
possible?
Cool with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, real quick, 2009. Was this right before I met you, or maybe a little bit after I met you, right, Rich?
Somewhere around that time.
Around that time. It was May 17th, right, so of 2009, and I was in this mode of life where I was writing, I was posting, I should say, one of these 26 chapters every other week. So I started on January 1st, January 14th, 29th, February 12th, and so on and so forth. I started getting into a routine where you know, I was writing every day. So those post days, those nights that I would post that chapter every other week, happened to be on Thursday night. So to quickly give you an idea of what would happen, I would post my chapter on Thursday night. I would take the next Friday off to kind of clear my head, but I had to immediately hit the ground running on Friday or Saturday to start going back to my outline and looking at the next chapter, because that, you know, it wasn't going to wait. I had to kind of get this stuff get this stuff going. So I would go back to that next chapter. I would write a real treatment of that, a treatment of that. I would flesh it out, print it out, sleep on it, come back, print it out, you know, take a red pen to it, sit there at lunch, apply my changes, and then go back to the computer, apply the changes, sleep on it again. I would go ironing out all the wrinkles maybe 3, 4, 5 times per chapter at that point. By the time I had done that, about, you know, 12 days had gone by and I was ready for posting. But after I had, say, for instance, I'm on chapter 5, and I've fleshed out chapter 5, I got all the dialogue, now I'm, you know, it's Sunday and it's set to go, it's set to get posted on Thursday. The stuff that I'm doing on chapter 5 is much more mechanical. I'm looking for just, you know, not just so much typos, but just efficient use of words and sentence structure and all that stuff. It's not really so much the storytelling itself. So while my left brain is really kind of playing editor on chapter 5, my storytelling part of my brain, it has to start thinking about chapter 6. Like in the back of my mind, I got chapter 6 on my radar. And, you know, the storytelling part of it and what needs to happen. And there was a lot of stress, like, oh, my God, I don't have to pull this stuff out of thin air, you know. So throughout the story takes place in San Pedro, the port town of L.A. So, and I lived down there at the time. And it takes place in really cool, real locations. And several chapters required that I actually just take little personal field trips just to walk in. Like, I would just walk into the diner where my next chapter was going to take place and just smell it. Take a look around, so I could describe the scene, you know, accurately with words. And speaking of smell, since a dog is the narrator, I have a dog writing in first person telling the story. The sense of smell is very important in the book, and there's actually at least one smell described in every chapter. And it's been fun to see who noticed that. But anyway, I'll get back to smell in a second. In May, I had met and then we're getting going way back. I had met Milena, who I'm my wife now, and we had met during that year online. There was this kind of connection to her and the Smith magazine project, but we could get into that another time. Anyway, I had never met this person. She was very stealth, didn't have any photos of her, but I was kind of like, you know, geeking out with her online, Facebook status updates. I did a lot of kind of fun conversation starting topics, and she was very funny, very, very witty, very smart. I could tell she was really bright and a good writer. She proposed, hey, listen, I'm going to be down in San Pedro, which is where I lived. Why don't we hook up and have a drink, you know? So I'm like, yeah, why not? So at this point, it was May. And I gave you all that backstory so that you could put it all together. It was May. I was coming up on chapter 9 when she emailed me, which is like on a Wednesday, and I was working on chapter 8. Right? She calls me on. We'll hook up on a place wherever to be determined on that Sunday. It was May 17th. I figured, you know what? I'm not going to have this person. I don't know who this person is. She's not going to be coming to my house. What I need to do anyway this week is I need to go do my little field trip, because in chapter 9 there is a dive bar down in on Pacific. It's called Harold's Place. Been there forever. And chapter 9 takes place there. And without giving too much about the story, that chapter 9 was pretty simple. My hero and the dog and another dude are gonna show up. They have to be somewhere at a very specific time. But they had to make a pit stop at Harold's Place. And what was going to happen in there, I wasn't exactly sure. What I did know, per the outline, was that there was going to be some sort of complication that was going to delay them from getting where they needed to be. Okay, flash forward to May 17th. I show up there. This girl's there. We kind of, you know, get all the introductions out of the way. We started, you know, playing some pool, whatever, small talk. And she had been expressing interest in what I had been doing online, and at least it seemed to me that she was bringing up the book, she was bringing up what happens next, and she had this curiosity about Under Angels, which I thought was kind of cool because, you know, it's so close to me, and to have somebody actually expressing interest in something that is almost like my private universe, I thought that was kind of cool. So she said, let's take a break, let's go over to the side there over by the shuffleboard, and let's talk about this. Okay, great. So we're sitting there, got our drinks, and I'm sitting there on a table with her, and she goes, okay, so tell me what happens next. And I'm like, well, this is perfect, because this is exactly, to be honest with you, this is exactly why I had you come down to this to this joint. What I've been doing as we've been doing this small talk, I've been actually looking at the ceiling. I've been noticing the clientele. I've been looking at the carpet. I've been smelling the place because I'm going to flesh out and describe this bar in the next week. I'm going to have to really start getting the words in. And so she goes, okay, so what do I do now? Or what are you doing now? I'm like, okay, here, check this out. I told her, close your eyes, right? So she goes, okay, good. She closes her eyes. She humors me. And I go, what do you smell? And she's like, oh, you know, wet carpet and fermented pineapple juice. Right? Bam, perfect. That's great. That's going to go in. I love it. She doesn't really know where I'm going with this, but I say, okay, look around the room. I don't know what's going to happen, but Pete and Mag are going to come walking into this bar. They're going to grab a drink. Pete's going to get a letter. He's going to be studying the letter, and something extraordinary is going to happen. I don't know if it's going to be a fire. I don't know if it's going to be a fight. Maybe somebody pulls out a shotgun. You know, kind of looking around the room. I'm coming up with this, just really brainstorming out loud to her. I go, hey, how about if that girl over there comes over and starts talking to Pete, and then her boyfriend gets pissed off, and then they get into this little brawl, and, you know, it. And I told her, it doesn't really matter what specifically happens. All I need is an extraordinary event to occur that would shake everything up and cause some sort of delay. As soon as I say that, Rich, we have an earthquake. Right? We have an earthquake. Yeah. You know, the billy balls start banging around. Everybody's kind of screaming and cheering, just like, you know, just another night in L.A. You know, the ceiling fans are swinging. She grabs my arm, digs her fingernails into my arm. I look at her, I'm just like, oh, my God. You know, that was it. And it was like it just came to me. And, like, so, you know, I ultimately went home that night and I wrote what is now chapter 9, and it's got the smell of fermented pineapple juice and wet carpet. It's got a girl with, you know, her hair that matches her dress. It's got a lot in there, and it does have that earthquake. So, you know, without that sort of, like, happenstance, chance, you know, luck, divine intervention, whatever, that chapter would have been much different. It never would have existed if I hadn't even decided to meet this stranger at this dive bar, you know. So right. I don't even remember what the question was, but
you pretty much just answered it. I was just, because I knew that story, and by listening to you talk about structure, to me that was a perfect example where you had your structure.
Got it.
And you knew what was going to happen, but yet there was this beautiful moment of this poetic
discovery.
Moment of divine intervention discovery that you allowed to come into this event and to actually shape that chapter in a great way.
Absolutely. Yeah. So to back up on that whole pantsers versus plotters thing, just because you're plotting things out and are setting things up rigidly, setting up the frame, if you will, that doesn't mean by any means, does that mean that you're denying yourself the process of discovery or the joy of finding things along the way? If anything, it's totally the opposite. There's a couple quotes that I love. I don't have them on my computer screen, but one is this. Orson Welles says the
absence of limitations is the enemy of art.
Thank you. The absence of limitations is the enemy of art, and it's so true. I can tell you, Rich, listen, dude, do something creative for me right now. And you'd come up with something that would be awesome. But it would be much more fascinating to me if I were to say, if I were to hand you a bar napkin and a crayon and said, okay, you have 2 minutes, come up with something creative.
Right.
To me, that's art. That's really where you're, you know, really forced to do stuff that is gonna blow doors. Another really good quote. I think it was McKee, and it's true. He says the desire to be free is one of the most suicidal notions an artist can have. He says, artists, you do not want to be free. What you want is strict limitations, so that you can kind of spread your wings and work within those limitations. And that's what we're talking about.
Well, you know, this reminds me of one of the most inspirational writing stories I've ever been privy to. Raymond Carver has this beautiful collection of essays and poems called Fires. And in this collection, he talks about how he came to be Raymond Carver, basically, as a writer. And he got married really young and had kids, and therefore his life became very structured. You know, as a father, he had to get a job. So the amount of time that he could bring to his art was somewhat limited, you know, and the whole thing came up because someone, or, you know, many people or a number of people throughout his career asked him, why haven't you ever written a novel? Why is it that you just mainly stick to short stories? And, yeah. You know, he tells this story, because my time was limited, I found that the best use of that time and how I could most creatively use that time, short stories came to me. And sure. And I did not have the time or the energy to really apply myself to anything bigger than a short
long
story. But
form,
I mean, look at Raymond Carver. I mean, structure, yeah. Because yeah. of that structure, you know, we are blessed with one of the greatest
That's right.
short storytellers
yeah.
that, you know, that we've ever had. And a yeah. lot of that is because of that structure.
We'd never have his stuff if it weren't for limitations, right? It's the
yeah.
limitations that made that possible.
And it's,
so, yeah.
it's funny how, you know, I mean, some people look at structure, you know, and they look at it as the devil, you know, and they're like, screw structure or whatever. You
yeah.
know, Raymond Carver, however he did it, you know, however he was able to do it, he looked at this structure and said, you know what, because of this structure, because of my limitations, I'm going to work within these limitations, and I'm going to do it the most artfully, you know, the most artful way I can.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the most apparent way to observe the importance of structure is music. I mean, look, you know, without structure, I mean, you got nothing, you got 20th century, just, you know, all this avant-garde stuff, but that's all breaking rules after knowing them, and, you know, there's that whole topic. But, there's no shortage of styles of music, but they're still based on principles. They're still based on pitch and, you know, timbre and rhythm and meter and math and all that stuff. And you know, anybody who would argue that music is limiting people and their way of expressing themselves, I think they'd have to look again, you know.
Yeah. You know, we're getting close to the end of our time, but I wanted you, because we're on the topic of music and because you've turned me on to this as of late, I was wondering if you could talk briefly about the Fibonacci sequence and how that relates to Tool's beautiful
sure.
musical
sure.
creation, Lateralis.
Yeah. Well, for people who aren't familiar with that, you and I were talking a little bit about mathematical principles, sacred geometry, stuff like that. That I'm a big fan of. I love numbers. In particular, there is a ratio. A lot of people have probably heard about the golden ratio, the golden mean, which can be found in nature. And there's a sequence of numbers called the Fibonacci sequence that was named after some dude, I guess, probably Italian, right? In which case, it's a sequence of numbers in which case every number in the sequence is the sum of the previous two numbers.
Exactly,
so
it starts with 0 and 1.
Right. Well, 0, 0, right. And then so it's 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, okay, and then 3 plus 5, 8, 8 plus 5, 13, 21, 34, 55, you see what's happening? 21
yep.
plus 34, 55, and so on and so forth. And that can be observed in everything in the universe, whether it's spiral galaxies or flower petals or snowflakes or even the human skeleton, the bones and stuff like that. And it gets almost into this like philosophical discussion of beauty and you know, is it really something that do we perceive it as beautiful because it's something that we feel at a primal level, or, you know, that whole thing. But I'm a big fan of that. I actually spent a lot of time doing some paintings, you know, and taking a 24 by 36 canvas and figuring out different ways to cut up that plane using Fibonacci sequence and the golden ratio. And by the way, the golden ratio, FYI, is just, it's a 1 to 1.618 ratio. So, like, you know, if the take a rectangle, is 1 inch by 1.618 inches. That's all connected to the Fibonacci sequence, because every adjacent number in the Fibonacci sequence is roughly 1 to 1.618 ratio. So a 5 to 8 is roughly 1 to 1.618, you know, 13 to 21, roughly 1 to 1.618, so on and so forth. So anyway, back to what we were talking about specifically, you know, we can actually go in and mine all these principles in the universe, these mathematical sort of all this logic, and actually use it as forms of expression, as kind of as a starting point, or even as a structure to kind of, you know, basically adopt it, borrow it, and then build within it. And back to what you were talking about, a awesome masterpiece example of this idea is the band Tool did an album in 2001, I think, called Lateralis. And you know, it's a popular record, but when analyzed really closely, you'll see that the title track, but the entire album, all the way down to the track listing, is heavily based on the Fibonacci sequence, whether it's the phrasing, the time signatures, the syllables in the verses, and so on and so forth. It's an absolute masterpiece. Not to mention the lyrical content, which has a lot, you know, it's talking a lot about the human experience and spiraling out and spiraling in and swinging back and forth. And, you know, the numbers in the Fibonacci sequence can be observed in the spirals, in the snail shells. If imagine a snail shell for a second. You're starting from the beginning, you're spiraling out. Starting at the middle, if you were to take the diameter of the first spin and then compare it to the diameter of the second swirl and then third, it's actually in the Fibonacci sequence if you look closely.
Wow.
So,
wow. You know, I was on iTunes yesterday searching out Lateralis, and funnily enough, you know, I couldn't find Tool's version, but talk about, you know, these sort of magical moments of happenstance. I did stumble upon this channel on iTunes called Rockabye Baby, these series of children's records where they do lullaby versions of rock songs and different things, and I found a Rockabye Baby version.
I love
Lateralis.
It. Yeah, killer. We need to do one with a Pharaoh Zaka.
But it was funny because, you know, they had one for Led Zeppelin. I was listening to, you know, a little to Stairway to Heaven. You know, all these different bands. It was pretty great. You know,
man,
it reminded me.
Hook me up with that.
I don't know if you, Rockabye Baby.
Okay.
I don't know if you caught this NPR segment. I think it was Friday or something of this past week, where there had been this musician / scientist from, I don't know if it was Sweden or something like that, where he had done this, and I think he built an app for it as well, where he was changing some of the most popular minor keyed songs to major keys and some of the most famous major key songs to minor.
Yes, I don't know who was doing that. I remember coming across something where they were taking a minor song and making it major, I think it was a Metallica song, and putting it into a major key.
Yeah, Metallica was one. They played R.E.M.'s "Losing My Religion," which was originally a minor keyed song, and then they played it.
Then it sounded like "Shiny Happy People" all of a sudden, right?
But they also played, you know, the standard "Summertime," which had been written originally as a minor keyed song, and they played it what it would sound like as a major. And it was, you know, and it was really, in a way, quite disturbing, but that was kind of what part of the whole segment was about, kind of turning our perceptions upside down.
And also it's a testament to what structure can achieve with mood. I mean, that's at the end of the day, the difference between major and minor is a structural thing, right? The notes and scale. So, you know, without that kind of rule to follow, that the difference between major and minor can't be realized. You know, it just doesn't exist if it's just free for all, just like random notes, right? So
exactly. And also how that the structure of major or minor then also played against the lyrics, the words also creates a certain tension in and of itself. And then if you suddenly change the structure, the key of the song, to something that perhaps plays too much against or plays too much with the words, then, you know, suddenly it doesn't sound as interesting anymore.
Right. Juxtaposition.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. So I'm wondering, we're getting close to the end of the line here. Let's go to the phones. We have Charlie from Piscataway. Where can people find you online?
All right. Well, you can find out more about Under Angels specifically. Just go to underangels.com. It's available on Amazon, as well as I got some links on some brick-and-mortar places. You can find me at jaced.com. That's jaced.com. Hit me up at Twitter, at jaced.
Nice.
We'll go from
nice.
There.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, it's been so great to have you,
you too,
Jace.
Brother.
Yeah, we've been both wanting this for a while, so I'm so glad it finally happened. You can find me, Rich Ferguson, online on Facebook, YouTube, at WeVoiceSing.com. Speaking of which, the theme music for the show is by WeVoiceSing. And for all your writerly needs, please visit Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit, online at RareBirdLit.com. This about wraps it up for another edition on Poet Escape. Hope you join me next week, and take care, everybody.
Thanks,
happy
Rich.
Springing forward. Take care, Jace.
Be safe. Your rule.